Although the public theatres were more exclusive than they had been in Shakespeare's day, they were not a solely aristocratic purlieu. Merchants and professional men, artists and lawyers, brought boxes and packed into the pit. Citizens took the cheaper second tier of boxes, and servants and shopkeepers crowded the gallery. The atmosphere of the town, with its coffee houses and shops, mingled with an older legacy from the court and the exile. Tom Killigrew, who ran the King's Company, had been a courtier of Charles I, while Davenant, manager of the Duke's Company, had been his poet laureate. Davenant had known the masks of Jonson and Inigo Jones, with their movable scenery trapdoors allowing figures to rise from the abyss and ropes to fly in angels from above, and he brought these techniques into the theatre. The scenery had none of the symbolic reference of the masks, but was there simply to delight and astonish, a favourite word, taking theatregoers from the tragic scenery of Sicily or Madrid to the familiar comic territory of the Strand or Spring Gardens. The raked stage behind the proscenium arch allowed grand vistas upstage, but an apron still projected into the pit, with boxes on both sides, so that the actors could play intimately to the audience, swapping jokes and innuendos. The season lasted from September to June, the months when the law courts were active and Parliament was in session. The playhouses were open 6 days a week, with actors rehearsing in the mornings, acting in the afternoons, and sometimes trooping off in the evenings to play for the court. Over a season, the companies might stage 50 plays, three different ones each week, old and new, ranging from broad farce to heroic verse drama. A new play rarely ran for more than 6 days at a time, with the playwright awarded the takings of the third night. The theatre was addictive, Pepys's diaries full of resolutions to give up going to plays, and equally full of his breaking them. Charles went to the theatre constantly, both for love of the plays, like Pepys, and because here he could play out his strategy of openness, sharing the entertainment, rubbing shoulders with the crowd, letting himself be seen. His presence there was part of the draw. The whole audience stood up as he entered and waited until he took his seat in the royal box in the centre of the first row of boxes. Everyone watched him, turning and gazing up from the pit, or leaning over the balconies of the boxes and galleries overhead. If he laughed, the play was a hit. If he stayed silent, yawned, or examined his nails, a chill fell on the production. The auditorium could squeeze in 700 at a pinch. In the pit, where the green baize-covered benches sloped gently back from the stage, the court gallants sat, shouting comments, ogling actresses and ribbing the orange sellers who stood in a row between the pit and the stage before the performance began. These were young girls, carefully selected for their looks, their friendliness, their willingness to run messages from the rakes to women in the audience, and their sparky ability to talk back. In the Theatre Royal, they were run by Mary Meggs, Orange Moll, who paid for full, free and sole liberty, license, power and authority to vend, utter and sell oranges, lemons, fruit, sweetmeats and all manner of fruiterers' and confectioners' wares and commodities. Tickets, little round brass discs, were bought in a room next to the theatre, but the seats were not reserved, allowing for much pushing and moving around. If you didn't like the play at one theatre, you could go to the other, as described in Etheridge's She Would If She Could, where the fops run from one playhouse to the other playhouse, and if they like neither the play or the women, they seldom stay any longer than the combing of their periwigs, or a whisper or two with a friend, and then they cock their caps and out they strut again. If the crowd was too great, people pushed in without paying, provoking Charles to issue a stern proclamation against the diverse persons who do rudely press and with evil language and blows force their ways into the two theatres. Brawls and fights broke out, swords were drawn, on at least one occasion a man was killed. Sometimes soldiers were stationed outside the theatres until the play was over. The packed theatres, suffocating on hot days, were ripe with the smell of sweat, powder and heady perfume. They buzzed with the chatter of fops, the heckling of the wits, the flutter of fans and the rustling of silk. In the crush there was always a scent of sex, with assignations in the pit and the boxes, glances from audience to stage and back. The audience started flowing through the doors up to an hour before the play was due to start, which was usually around 3:30. The mood was like that of a club, where the latest gossip was exchanged. Cliques formed, rivalries brewed, political deals were made and information exchanged. The news heard here spread outwards to dinner tables and coffee houses and through letters to friends and relations in the country.